This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio, here on NPR One.
Tom Wilmer, come along and join me for a conversation with Don McPhail.
Hi, Tom. It's a pleasure to meet you.
I know. And we know each other by emails and cyber different dimensions. One of the reasons that you first contacted me in that communication, you wanted to let me know about you had written two books, fairly recent books.
They're fairly recent. And I started writing about 7 years ago when I retired from the travel business. One of them takes place in 1929, essentially about the stock market crash, a novel that's historical fiction, and it started out really as a family memoir, a tribute to my dad.
But the interesting thing about both your books, they're fiction, but there's a lot of truth in them on different dimensions, and your Millionaire's Cruise was a real cruise by Matson Line at that time, correct?
It was. It was a real cruise, which happened annually, I believe. They did a 90-day Pacific cruise in 1929, I know. And on the 1931 cruise, the reason I know about 29 is my dad was on the 1931 cruise, and that's where he met my mom, who was a special nurse on board the ship.
And there just happens to be a nurse on board that ship in your novel.
Yeah, that's true. And I converted the novel from 31, when they actually met, into 1929, because a friend of mine said when he read one of my manuscripts that my own family history was sort of interesting, but if I really wanted to write a book, it ought to be about that 29 cruise because of all the millionaires who lost all their money in that 29 tour.
Time, place, no cell phones, no satellite. These poor guys are out in the high seas, and it was, what, a day or two sometimes to get word, or a day to get word back, and they're bankrupt before they can react.
That's part of the charm of the book, where it's a mystery of sorts, because while the reader knows what happened and knows there was a market crash, none of the characters knows that. So there's a term for that, literary irony or something. But, yeah.
But again, your fiction book, this is real. This really happened to these couples and whatnot on that cruise.
Well, it did. And I wanted the book to be grounded in visible truths. So many of the chapters have the headlines of that particular day in 1929 of what happened, whether the Dodgers won the World Series or the Cubs did, or whether the market went up or down and what the market price was, because I wanted the market number to be in the reader's eyes as the book went along.
So it really is a journey back in time, both of your books, in historical moments, historic events, whatever was going on at that time, and you go through basically a century of time through your two books.
I do, and that was intentional, obviously, of course, and also to show the parallels between that time and what we're going through now, because my second book I wrote because, frankly, I was pissed off about the political situation where people were being targeted by race or by religion or by color, and I wanted to write a book that was readable, that wasn't a screed, but that touched on how unfair that is and unwise that is.
And give us some tangible examples in your book and how you bring that to life in a historic moment in time.
Well, the second book, which was...
And the name of the second book?
It's called The Guest from Johannesburg. It's had a variety of names while I was working on it, but it came down to The Guest from Johannesburg, who is a writer who's doing a lot of interviewing, who happens to be from South Africa. And my main character is...
And my interview is kind of like your book in that we're jumping all over the place. And the context of South Africa dovetails back to you and your family's history.
That's right. My dad was born in South Africa just at the turn of the 19th century. While I wasn't raised there, I was raised hearing about it. He died when I was very young, when I was 4. So he was always a hero in my mind, but also an unknown person. and I could sort of fantasize all I wanted to make him this great character. And that's pretty much what I did with Duff Malone in both of my books.
Duff Malone, like your dad, there's a parallel there that you followed very closely. Was that a way to kind of breathe life into your dad, to get to know him?
Oh, very much so, because we knew nothing about how he actually was raised and actually lived. And it was a way to pay back and to pay a tribute to him. I gave him a long and enjoyable life in this book because he didn't have one, and I have had a good life, and I thought that was only fair.
What did you learn about your dad and your mom throughout this whole process?
That's a good question. The tough part I learned was really about my mom, because I grew up being very hateful toward her because of her alcoholism and the way she operated as a mom. And that was all I realize now, because she lost her husband at a very young age.
So there was a real cathartic process for you.
Very much a cathartic process. And I was able to forgive her at the very end, which is part of a predictable thing that happens when you work through a difficult issue. And you confront it, you wrestle with it a little bit, and then you maybe have a little compassion.
So it must have been, in some respects, this whole journey for you, a painful journey, but a healing one at the same time.
Absolutely healing, much more healing than painful. Mm-hmm. The hard part was when I wrote in the very first book about my dad's childhood in South Africa, because I gave him the childhood I had had, where he loses his dad early, where his mom turned to drinking, where he turned very bitter and angry and hurt. And we watch him grow out of it, and no secret there, watch the author grow out of it too, I suppose.
Interesting. Whereas, you do have some memories of him.
Almost none. Almost none. Only what I've read and what I heard about in those legends I would listen to as a kid.
Were you able to meet friends of his that infilled some stories for you?
A couple things about friends, yes. One, I went into sales with United Airlines after I graduated from San Francisco State. And one of my customers among the travel agents I made sales calls on was a man by the name of Charlie Kleiss at American Express at Post Street in San Francisco. And Charlie had been a shipmate, that is, a cruise director, along with my dad.
In real life.
In real life, on many cruises. They raised hell together, I'm sure. And he was a wonderful man. He never talked much about my dad other than how great he was. He didn't divulge either of their secrets.
Interesting. But it must have been illuminating for you.
Yeah, it was, because it gave me an interest in that period, in the ethics of that period, the way people were genteel and kind and a little more sophisticated travelers than we see nowadays.
One of the paradoxes is you're dipping back into time, you're dipping back into history, but you go back and breathe life into that moment in time in that same freshness that we are experiencing today. So it's not history. It's like a transported, you know, new moment in time. So it must have given you kind of a rejuvenated vision of what the life they lived, the lens that they saw the world.
That is true. You could see their social, political, economic situations. We know our own if we pay attention, situations. I was able to see some parallels, but also I was driven because travel nowadays isn't as much fun as it used to be, isn't as glamorous as it used to be, because no period in history had travel as wonderful as those cruise years in the 20s, 30s, 40s, and the airline years in the 50s, 60s, 70s. I happened to work in the 50s, 60s, 70s, so I could talk about those, but I didn't put those in my book. I really harked back to the real elegant days of travel.
The second book, a little bit more.
Guess from Johannesburg started out as a history of Pan American World Airways. My dad worked for Pan Am for about 8 years, and he died in 1944. He was with Pan Am in New York. He was at Idlewild. And I wanted to build something around his story and the fact that he left American Express, where he was in my first book, and joined Pan Am, as he did in my second book. I wanted to tell Pan Am's story because they grew up as a legendary company. And to most of us, Tom, yourself included, we look at Pan Am as this great airline, this great world carrier that set the standard, a really high standard.
I saw an old advertisement the other day, and it was You would think it was a military ad for this pilot, you know, traveling the world, using Pan Am as a metaphor, literal metaphor in their advertising for America.
A lot of that came because, and you'll see it in my book, it started out as a book about Pan American Airways going across the Pacific, building these stations at Midway and Guam and Wake Island and those places. But that story became overwhelmed by World War II and Japan's move across the Pacific toward Pearl Harbor and coming toward the United States. So the one story of World War II became much larger than the story about Pan American. However, Pan Am's officers, managers, directors, all wore these Navy-designed uniforms, military uniforms, with a reason, because Pan Am did an awful lot of work for the government during the war, and it gave them an elevated position when they were overseas negotiating with foreign countries.
You use that uniform in your book at one point.
Yeah, I do. It helps Duff Malone get home from a difficult meeting in New York when there wasn't any airspace because Pearl Harbor had happened, and his wife Christy, who is a registered nurse at Tripler Army Hospital, was right in the midst of the Pearl Harbor attack, and he had to get home. And they hadn't talked to each other, they hadn't heard from each other.
There are so many layers to your story, to all your stories in the books. For anybody that has traveled or been around, it breathes this life and freshness into one's memories. And as you know, I was in Hawaii as a young guy, and it was so vivid. It was such a stirring the pot of memories to read your books about Hawaii a long time ago.
Well, it is. The first book was in Hawaii in the 20s, and I had a great time trying to describe it then. And then the second book, I guess, from Johannesburg, we're talking about Hawaii in our era, Tom's and mine. And yeah, there was so much going on. The races getting used to each other, the Haoles coming in, or the local guys beating up people, that kind of stuff. It was worth talking about, and underneath this wonderful cross-current of the Hawaiian culture that stabilizes people, that is so kind, it's a wonderful culture to talk about.
And what's interesting, the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Well, right.
You talk about in your book the neighborhood where the prostitutes and drug deals and whatnot on Hotel Street.
Yep.
In the time and place is what, 30s, 40s, and yet last week, I'm reading an article in a Honolulu newspaper about those same identical problems on Hotel Street.
When I lived in Honolulu, I was in the hotel business for about 6 years there. And I lived about four blocks from Hotel Street. I lived in Chinatown, and I loved it. And every night, I would walk through Chinatown to get to my office and back to my apartment. It was so interesting to see. Number one, you'd see a lot of the same drunks on the corner, you know, asleep on the street. Number two, most of them were Haoles. They were not Hawaiians. They were not Japanese. They were not Filipino or Vietnamese who lived in that area. They were Haole guys. What that told me was there are pockets in the Hawaiian culture that take care of their own people and look after each other, and there isn't that strength of character within the Haole community or the visitor community or the bums who happen not to be local.
There's another moment in time that I think you do a very deft job of breathing life, and that's the moment, the day of the attack on Pearl Harbor.
It's been described so many times that everybody's read about it and everybody knows about it, whether they've read it or not. I want it to be a different take, and Christy, who is Duff Malone's bride, their courtship was in the first book when she was the nurse on the ship. I wanted her to be a major part of that, and I really wanted to describe and think through what people must have felt when the attack came. Because as I think we know, in real life, when tragic things happen, they seem unreal. They don't seem real. In books and movies where there's a musical background or a dramatic lead up, yeah, it seemed like the natural next step. Well, I wanted it to happen in a real way where you couldn't tell that it was fiction. I wanted the airplanes to seem familiar and like they were local and they were U.S. airplanes, and they weren't. They were Japanese. Mm-hmm. I wanted her to have a job to go to. She could have run away and gone home, but she went in to help whoever was injured because you sure as hell knew somebody was going to be injured, and in fact, they were. So I wanted it to be realistic, but I also wanted to have it a little bit charming as well.
We'll be right back after this short break.
My name is Roseanne Cash. I listen to WNYC in New York. And in fact, NPR is all I listen to. And if I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.
In real life, your mom and dad, what's their connection with Hawaii?
You know, I don't know. I don't know if they were ever there together. They must have been on the one stopover that they were on the cruise together. But to be honest, I don't know, because they didn't talk, like most people, like our parents, they don't talk about their past, probably because their past includes coming out of the Depression when they're in the 1930s, and World War II, which nobody wants to talk about, and bad things, and parents wouldn't discuss it. So, and that also was the underlying cause of drinking or emotional issues and family pressures and those kind of things. So, it's important to know those things.
And when you were a kid, where were you born and where did your family live?
I was born in Santiago, Chile.
How did that happen?
Yeah. Well, my dad was with American Express for about 20 years after being a cruise director for many years, and then meeting my mother as a ship's nurse, he settled down. No more cruise director fun. And he settled down and accepted jobs in different parts of the world. He was assigned to Santiago to create tours between Santiago and Buenos Aires and to run that office. And so sightseeing tours, those kinds of things. And I was born there, but we moved to the States when I was about 2 years old.
And you do, again, a deft job of breathing life and painting a picture of that place at that time.
Well, I wanted people to understand what the world must have been like back then. I didn't. I was an infant, so I did have to study and I did have to learn, but that was the fun part of it. That's the fun part of being a writer. You can do that.
I know this is a big question. What did you learn?
Oh, that's a good question. I learned that I ought to do a third book because I'm just now learning how to write. I liked the first two. I'm proud of them. I was glad how they turned out. I'd love to write a third one, but at age 80, I'm not making any long-term plans.
Well, time, age, kind of subjective. My mom's 95, and she golfed 18 holes on her birthday. So.
Well, I'm motivated now. I couldn't have done that when I was 18 to hit that golf ball.
Yeah, I knew better.
Yeah.
What would you do different in your writing today that you didn't know before?
Well, I'd start writing sooner. And I don't think I'd do much differently in terms of the stories I came up with. I would also write some other types of books. I would like.
So a third book, if you were to do one, anything come to mind?
Well, it would take Duff further on. He'd be looking back from age 90, or we would lead him chronologically into age 90, he and Christy, and they would describe what we're seeing now and what a strange environment we're in, because the media has changed, newspapers, television, they've all changed. Our politics, well, social, political, economic, all of that has changed, and there'd be a way of weaving it in to show how it hasn't really changed as far as human nature is concerned and as far as why it changed.
What would you do differently as a writer of how you tell the story, of how you craft it and put it together?
Well, I'd probably go to some writing classes, and as I did as a younger man in the 80s, where you could critique each other and you could talk in groups. I wrote these independently, and what I would do, to finally answer your question, is work with a group to collaborate with ideas, not necessarily with the writing, but trade ideas, stimulate each other, push each other, get better at what you do, accept weaknesses that might be there, and then adjust and write better.
A little bit more about you and your life journey. You work for United Airlines in marketing?
Yeah, I started out as a part-time reservations agent when I was at San Francisco State getting my degree.
So you were at SFO?
No, actually, I was in downtown
Union Square. Union Square.
Union Square, second floor, right looking out on Union Square and reservations. And then when I graduated, I went into sales. That's the first step in management. So I was in outside sales for about a year. Then I was hired by headquarters office to be the national commercial sales manager for the company, which was a little overwhelming, but I enjoyed it. I learned a lot. I think I did a good job. Then I transferred out to San Francisco. I missed the rolling hills, and I wanted to get out of Chicago and back to San Francisco.
Back to San Francisco, back to the day, the heyday of airlines. I remember as a kid, one of the kind of most glittery, eye-catching things that you would see around Union Square were American Airlines, Pan Am, United, their retail. They were like a shopping mall stores. I mean, they had big showrooms and beautiful displays. What a lost empire.
Well, what a reflection on travel back then, too, because it was still under regulation by the government, so the competition wasn't so bloodthirsty as it is now. The carriers were elegant. They were classy competitors. They were more cooperating than competing. And passengers were more structured, just like the city in those days. You would dress up, women would wear gloves and hats and heels, and men would wear suits and ties and hats. And it was a very different era then. That's all gone from Union Square.
Give us a word picture of what you wrote in your book about Pan Am's offices down in Union Square.
Yeah, I used to make sales calls on Pan Am. I never worked for them. I always loved the company, but never worked for them. United was across the square. The St. Francis Hotel was across the square. You would walk around and admire the people because everybody was civilized back then. And as you walked around Union Square, you'd go past Gump's if you went to your left, and a small old hotel whose name eludes me. And then you'd see across the corner, you'd see TWA in the middle of the block on a ground level. You'd see Pan American had a ground level ticket office. Further in the block, there was KLM, I believe, and I know there was Philippine Airlines on the corner.
But these were beautiful graphic, brilliant colors. Just totally eye-catching.
Well, the offices were all glass, filled with color, filled with well-dressed people who were taking great care of customers. And the pride was competing for service. Mm-hmm. And those days, it wasn't for price, it was service.
Interesting. There are other nuances in your book and reading your books that just were spellbinding to me, and maybe extra so because of our shared love and appreciation and study of history. And you even have little detail-y things, like some of your characters go to Sears restaurant for breakfast. Sears has been right off Union Square since, I think, 1928. They started in San Luis Obispo and for some reason relocated a couple of years later to San Francisco, and they are still there. And that people love going there today that have that appreciation for history, because nothing's changed at Sears since I was a kid.
Well, that is true. You know, Sears Fine Foods, which I think is its full name, used to be up the hill slightly on Powell Street, up one half block off Union Square. And then, for whatever reason, maybe expansion, it moved down to its current location. And then it went out of business for maybe a day or two when a gentleman by the name of Man J. Kim, who was a restaurateur originally from Korea, a wonderful man, purchased it and restored it because he also loved it as we do and had those Swedish pancakes and the wonderful decor and the funkiness. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Sears Fine Foods is still there in its second location.
That's really cool. Okay. So in some ways, both of your books is a story, is communicating to friends and family that haven't been born yet, a legacy for you, a voice that you feel passionate about telling and sharing.
It is, but it suffers from the fact that we didn't know, our generation didn't hear much from our parents, so I had to make a lot of it up. But it's an era that has so much color and so there are so many parallels to current times that it was fun to make up. One parallel has to do with what I started out on a few minutes ago, and that is about racism and generalizing about people of color, about international people, people from overseas who don't look like us. It's very interesting. I read a fact somewhere that something like 75% of Americans who could have passports do not have passports, which means 25% do, 75% don't, if that's accurate.
I heard currents around 19 to 20 do have passports today.
Well, to me, that makes it awfully easy to frighten 80% of the people of our country who've never been anywhere, have never been out of the country, and so their view of a culture in the Middle East or in Asia or in Latin America can be whatever people tell them it is, and they can be frightened to death.
It's the us and them.
Yeah, the us and them and the general oversimplifications. So In writing my book, I wanted to talk about times when that has happened in our very own wonderful country, and that is internment of Japanese Americans, World War II. I worked for a guy at Hawaiian Airlines by the name of Mas Takano, wonderful man, dear friend. I saw him just the other night. He's 88 now, and he's a charming, wonderful friend. I wanted to tell his story because he was raised at Amache internment camp in Colorado, in desolate Colorado, after going through two assembly places.
Horse stalls.
And it was a crime and is a crime. And for him to be this gentle, resilient, not hold a grudge, he loves America. He's even more patriotic than I ever would be. Because he loves his country, he was in the army afterward. He demonstrates to me the resilience of people, even when they've really been crushed. So I wanted to tell his story in an acceptable, understandable manner that wouldn't be a screed again. It would be logical and kind. And so I told Masa's one little part of his story as a little kid, how it felt being removed from his elementary school, his family removed from their home in Alameda where he'd been born and raised, taken to these prison internment camps, along with all these hundreds and thousands of other Japanese Americans, and what his life must have been like and what his disappointments were, and how his parents, first generation Japanese, lost not only their homes and their dignity, but they lost the authority they had because in the internment camps, the Americans wouldn't let them have any authority within the camp in terms of leadership and guidance and counsel. They gave that to the second generation who were younger kids. And how humiliating is that, both for the kids who know it's disrespectful and for the parents who've lost everything and now they've lost their self-respect. I needed to put that in because it's a story that needs to be told. It needs to be understood.
Before we go, let's loop back to the world of Pan American Airways, which is a literal metaphor for 20th century America. And the demise of Pan American Airways in many ways was the demise of a part of the heart and soul and fabric of America.
That's beautifully stated because it is such a parallel. If you look at how hard they worked to build that airline, how Juan Tripp, the founder and president and chairman, the deals he made, the courage he had to maneuver government contracts and employees and equipment and engineering, all those things, and create something that didn't exist before. Others were creating airlines too in the Netherlands and in England and in France and Germany, but he did it in the United States, and he wanted it to be a worldwide carrier. He wanted it to be the flag carrier. And to have, number one, introduced it across the Pacific was quite surprising because everybody assumed it would be across the Atlantic. Well, because of Hitler and Germany and the Atlantic at the time and Russia and so forth, he chose the Pacific. Also because the state of the art of flying, it could only go so far. An airplane could only fly so far. The furthest it had to go was from San Francisco to Hawaii. After that, they could get to Midway and Wake Island, and then on to Guam, and then on to Manila, and so forth. They took risks, and they had to work very hard to do it. In my book, I describe how hard they worked to create those places that in the islands, or the atolls, they weren't even islands. They were little tiny slips of land, and create those overnight destinations so they could refuel and continue across the Pacific.
Other cool historic aside about aviation history is that there was no infrastructure. There were no runways anywhere. And so by some karmic miracle, the advent of the amphibious aircraft made it possible to land anywhere where there's water.
Well, and then, well, that's where San Francisco and Alameda and Treasure Island come in because they took off from there, flew under the Golden Gate Bridge, not over it, on their very first flight, the China Clipper, and on into the Pacific. But, yeah, they worked very hard to create that. To get back to our metaphor about America, North America anyway, is worked very hard, constructed this huge, what became a huge, very successful operation, highly respected by all travelers, And then eventually it started to expand too far, as many corporations do these days, and went into the hotel business. They owned office buildings. They had a small business aircraft company, and they expanded, and they expanded their own management salaries, and they invested in large aircraft, 747s. From what I read, the 747 couldn't fly at that time quite long enough to benefit Pan Am, but it benefited some of their competitors who had shorter routes. So Pan Am helped create the 747.
Well, some historical references talk about Lockerbie bombing and the downing of the Pan Am being the ultimate death knell for that airline.
Well, because of the timing and because of the ferocity and the tragedy of it, yes, I guess it was. I think they had their own death watch going because they had overspent, overinvested, become too bureaucratic in some people's eyes from what I'm reading. And it was Lockerbie that may have been the nail that did it, but it's kind of like looking at a football game and saying that Miss Football at the end of the game lost the game, when it's usually not true. The game's lost in the first half, and in a lot of the second half, it just, you notice the ending because it's so visible.
Parting words, parting thoughts.
I appreciate the chance to interact with somebody who has actually read my books and who likes them for the right reasons, because you picked out some issues that I planned in the book that very few people have seen, and I appreciate that and I respect that. I have a lot of respect for travel writing. It isn't easy these days. Journalism isn't easy, and I'm just honored to be here talking about myself and my book.
In self-promotion time, to learn more about Don McPhail's world, website, and how to buy your book.
I have a website that's DonaldMcPhail.com. Of course, it's got the www and all that. DonaldMcPhail.com. The books are available through any brick-and-mortar bookstore in the country. All you got to do is ask for it. They'll order it. You can get it from Amazon and all the other Barnes & Noble and other online stores as well.
Don McPhail, what a wonderful, joyous day to meet you and hang out and visit and learn about your life.
Hey, this is California. We're at Fort Hunter Liggett. It's a lovely place. A Julia Morgan design building, William Randolph Hearst history. It's on a military base that I had never seen before, even though I spent 4 years in the military. Yeah, it's a treat, real treat. Thank you, Tom.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com. Our associate producers include Rebecca Nolan, Newfoundland, Canada, Kim Schneider from Michigan, Elaine Masters in San Diego, Julie Henning, Eugene, Oregon, and Steve Cook, contributing from Little Rock, Arkansas, host of Arkansongs on NPR affiliate KUAR.
Associate producers include Rebecca Nolan, Newfoundland, Canada, Molly Blaisdell, San Francisco, and Katya Singel, San Luis Obispo, California.
Underwriting support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided in part by the Society of St. Vincent de Paul. People often associate the Society of St. Vincent de Paul with thrift stores. Donations like clothing, your gently used couch, or still serviceable washing machine generate funds to assist the Society in putting food on the table for people in need, or keeping the lights on and families in their homes. To find a St. Vincent de Paul thrift store in your area, visit svdpusa.org.